Welcome to So Ordered, where we create audio readings of SCOTUS decisions to make them more accessible to the public. At the time of creating this podcast, the Supreme Court of the United States does not release audio of the court's decisions. Our mission is to make it so the public can be better informed on decisions of the court by using AI to generate audio of written opinions. The case before us today is Strippech v. Securities and Exchange Commission, docket number 25466, decided June 4, 2026. Before reading the opinion itself, here is a brief summary of the case and the questions presented. Strippech engaged in numerous fraudulent schemes involving at least 20 penny stock companies. After discovering the schemes, the Securities and Exchange Commission brought a civil enforcement action against him, charging 6 counts of securities fraud and 1 count of selling unregistered securities. Strippech consented to the entry of judgment and agreed that the court could order disgorgement. When the commission sought to recover over $4.1 million in disgorgement, Strippech objected, arguing that the request violated the court's decision in Louvet Securities and Exchange Commission because the commission lacked evidence that his schemes caused investors any financial loss. The Ninth Circuit rejected that argument, deepening a split among the courts of appeals. The question presented was whether the Securities and Exchange Commission may seek equitable disgorgement under Title 15 of the United States Code, Section 78U, Subsection D, Paragraphs 5 and 7, without showing that investors suffered pecuniary harm. The court held, a showing of pecuniary loss to investors is not required before the Securities and Exchange Commission may obtain a disgorgement award. Even assuming that disgorgement remains an equitable remedy bound by traditional equitable principles, those principles allow a court to deprive a wrongdoer of his unlawful gains without proof that any victim suffered a measurable financial loss. The judgment of the Ninth Circuit was affirmed. Justice Gorsuch delivered the opinion for a unanimous court. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion. As a reminder, the audio is an AI-generated reading of a published opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States. The voice you will hear has been synthesized to loosely resemble that of the justice that wrote the opinion. All tone, inflection, pacing, and emphasis are produced by the AI model and should not be attributed to any justice. The text itself has been lightly adapted to aid in the creation of the spoken delivery. This is a project to attempt to make court decisions more accessible to the public, and any substantive changes during the reading are completely unintentional. Please visit www.supremecourt.gov to read the opinion published by the court. You can find a link directly to the opinion in this episode's description. As the audio is AI-generated, you may hear some audio glitches, including odd pronunciation, noticeable pauses, or repeated words. We're continually working to improve our process to reduce these, and we appreciate you sticking with us as we improve the listening experience. The following is the opinion of the court in Strippech v. Securities and Exchange Commission.
The Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, may sometimes seek a court order directing those who violate federal securities laws to disgorge their ill-gotten gains to wronged investors. This case presents the question whether, as a condition of securing that relief, the SEC must prove victims of the securities law violation have suffered pecuniary loss. The SEC's disgorgement powers have a long and nuanced history. When Congress created the SEC in the 1930s, it did not authorize the commission to seek monetary awards for violations of federal securities laws. Instead, the only statutory remedy the SEC could pursue was a judicial injunction barring future violations of securities laws. Kokesh v. SEC decided in 2017. With time, that changed. In 1990, for example, Congress provided the Commission with a full panoply of additional enforcement tools, including the power to seek monetary penalties for certain violations. But even then, nothing in statutory law expressly authorized the SEC to seek and receive a judicial order directing a defendant to disgorge his ill-gotten gains to wronged investors. Instead, that remedy emerged like this. Beginning in the 1970s, the SEC persuaded lower courts to order those who had violated federal securities laws to disgorge their unlawfully earned gains as an exercise of the court's inherent equity power to grant relief ancillary to an injunction. Quoting SEC v. Texas Gulf Sulphur Company, 1970, at first, some courts seemed to conceive of this remedy as a type of restitution to victims. SEC v. Texas Gulf Sulphur Company, 1307, 1308, CA 2, 1971. But eventually, the SEC began routinely seeking and obtaining disgorgement awards that went beyond compensating victims by sending disgorged funds to the United States Treasury. Not only that, the sums disgorged often exceeded the profits the defendant had gained as a result of his violation. This court first addressed these developments in 2017 in Kokesh. There, the SEC argued that no statute of limitations applied to its actions seeking disgorgement. We disagreed, observing instead that 28 United States Code, Section 2462 imposes a 5-year limitations period for any civil fine, penalty, or forfeiture, quoting Section 2462. Given what disgorgement had become, we held, the remedy amounted to a civil penalty subject to Section 2462's limitations period. In reaching that holding, though, we express no opinion on whether courts possess authority to order disgorgement in SEC enforcement proceedings to begin with, nor did we express any opinion on whether courts have properly applied disgorgement principles in this context. We agreed to answer those questions 3 years later in Lieu v. SEC, decided in 2020. While the term disgorgement still appeared nowhere on the list of its statutory remedies, the SEC stressed that Congress had enacted 15 United States Code, Section 78 UD, in 2002, a provision allowing it to seek any equitable relief that may be appropriate or necessary for the benefit of investors. And, the Commission argued, that statute's reference to equitable relief was broad enough to authorize its existing practice of seeking disgorgement awards. See Lieu. We agreed in part. Yes, we held, equitable relief can encompass a disgorgement remedy. But no, we added, the term equitable relief does not capture the kind of disgorgement the SEC had often sought in lower courts. And though we did not purport to set forth all the bounds of traditional equity practice applicable under Section 78 UD, we did identify some key limitations on the disgorgement remedy authorized by that statute's equitable relief language. Among those limitations were these two. First, because equity seeks to deprive wrongdoers of their profits from unlawful activity, we held that any remedy must be limited to the defendant's net profits, not total revenues derived from his securities law violations. Second, because equity aims to deliver wrongful gains to wronged victims, a point reinforced by Section 78 UD's focus on investors, we concluded that any amounts the SEC secures must be awarded for victims. Accordingly, we held that the SEC must return a defendant's gains to wronged investors, contrary to its practice of depositing a defendant's gains with the Treasury. As much as it resolved, Lieu left some questions unanswered. We did not decide whether the SEC may seek disgorgement when it is infeasible to distribute the collected funds to investors, nor did we decide what showing the Commission might have to make to prove infeasibility. Those questions remain for another day yet, as they have no bearing on this case. Lieu also left unaddressed what statute of limitations might apply to disgorgement actions under Section 78 UD. True, Kokesh had held that Section 2462's 5-year limitations period governed actions seeking disgorgement because, at that time, the remedy amounted to a civil penalty. But going forward, Lieu clarified, disgorgement would need to follow traditional equitable principles, which do not confer the power to impose a penalty. See also Marshall v. Vicksburg, 1873, stating, equity never lends its aid to enforce a penalty. So the question of what limitations, period, if any, might attach to SEC disgorgement actions once again became uncertain. 6 months after Lieu, Congress again addressed the SEC's remedial powers. In doing so, it left intact the Commission's authority to seek equitable relief in Section 78 UD. But in Section 78 UD, Congress now explicitly added disgorgement to the SEC's list of enforcement tools. and it provided that the SEC may seek disgorgement of any unjust enrichment by the person who receives such unjust enrichment as a result of his securities law violation. Finally, Congress added two new statutes of limitations, one governing equitable relief generally, and another expressly addressing disgorgement, see Section 78UD. All that brings us to this case. Shripetch engaged in numerous fraudulent schemes involving at least 20 penny stock companies. Some were classic pump-and-dump operations in which Mr. Shripetch and his co-conspirators obtained shares of penny stock companies, promoted the companies to others, watched the share price rise, and then promptly sold. On discovering the schemes, the SEC brought a civil enforcement action against Mr. Shripetch, charging him in court with 6 counts of securities fraud and 1 count of selling unregistered securities. Mr. Shripetch consented to the entry of judgment against him and agreed that the court could order disgorgement. When the SEC proceeded to seek over $4.1 million in disgorgement, however, Mr. Shripetch objected. As relevant here, he argued that the SEC's request violated Liu for a very specific reason. The commission lacked evidence that his schemes caused investors to suffer any financial losses, so there were no victims for whom disgorgement could be awarded under Liu. The SEC disagreed, arguing that investors could qualify as victims under Liu, even if they lost no money. And the commission asserted that, regardless, its evidence demonstrated that investors had suffered pecuniary loss as a result of Shripetch's wrongdoing. The district court accepted the commission's second argument. As it saw things, the SEC had done enough to show that Mr. Shripetch's investors had suffered pecuniary loss. Accordingly, the district court did not decide whether such a showing was required in the first place. When Mr. Shripetch appealed, however, the Ninth Circuit proceeded differently. Accepting the SEC's threshold argument, it held that a finding of pecuniary harm is not required before a court orders disgorgement. The Ninth Circuit acknowledged that, under Liu, disgorgement must be awarded for victims. But it rejected Mr. Shripetch's submission that victim must be narrowly defined as an individual or entity that has suffered pecuniary harm. As support, the court pointed to common law sources indicating that a claimant seeking disgorgement need only show an actionable interference by the defendant with the claimant's legally protected interests. Given its conclusion that the SEC did not need to show pecuniary loss at all, the court declined to decide whether the SEC had in fact made a showing of pecuniary harm. The Ninth Circuit's decision deepened a split among the courts of appeals. While the First and Ninth Circuits have held that the SEC may obtain disgorgement without proving investors have suffered pecuniary loss, the Second Circuit has taken the opposite view. Compare SEC v. Navalier, 2024, and SEC v. Govile, 2023. We granted certiorari to resolve that disagreement. We begin with two statutory provisions, Section 78UD5 and 78UD7. Enacted in 2002, Section 78UD5 allows the SEC to obtain any equitable relief that may be appropriate or necessary for the benefit of investors. Liu held this provision permits a court to order disgorgement so long as the remedy adheres to traditional equitable principles. After Liu, Congress adopted Section 78UD, subsection 7, which expressly allows the Commission to seek disgorgement in enforcement proceedings. Before us, the parties spill much ink debating how the addition of Section 78UD, subsection 7, affects the scope of the SEC's disgorgement powers. Mr. Shripetch contends that the same equitable constraints Liu held applicable to disgorgement under Section 78UD5 also apply under Section 78UD7. That is so, he says, because Congress meant simply to codify Liu when it adopted Section 78UD7 and expressly authorized a disgorgement remedy for the first time. Beyond that, Mr. Shripetch argues, the primary function of Congress's work was to resolve what limitations period should apply to the SEC's disgorgement remedy after the unsettling effect Liu had on that question. The Commission sees things differently. It concedes that under Section 7A UD7, as under Section 7A UD5, the SEC may seek disgorgement of only a defendant's net profits that were causally connected to his unlawful conduct. After all, Congress's new statutory language authorizing disgorgement permits the Commission to seek no more than the unjust enrichment a defendant received as a result of his securities law violations. At the same time, the SEC claims that Section 7A UD7 differs from Section 7A UD5 in one important respect. While we held in lieu that disgorgement under Section 78 UD5 must be awarded for victims of the defendant's securities law violations, the SEC argues this constraint does not apply when it seeks disgorgement under the new provision Congress added after lieu. As a result, the Commission says, in actions under Section 78 UD7, it does not have to connect the unlawful profits it seeks to any specific victims, and the government may resume its former practice of keeping disgorgement awards for itself. To decide this case, we need not resolve that dispute. The question we face is not whether Congress's recent amendments free the SEC from the traditional equitable rule that disgorgement must be awarded for victims. The only question we took this case to resolve is whether the SEC must show that an investor suffered a pecuniary loss before it may secure a disgorgement remedy under either Section 7A UD5 or Section 7A UD7. And to answer that question, we can simply assume without deciding that disgorgement under Section 7A UD7 remains an equitable remedy, so that it must comply with traditional equitable rules, including the rule that disgorgement must be awarded for victims. Even assuming all that to be true, we conclude that a showing of pecuniary loss is not required before an investor may qualify as a victim of an offender's wrongdoing entitled to compensation. Perhaps the easiest way to see why traditional equitable principles associated with disgorgement do not require proof of pecuniary loss is to contrast that remedy with the legal remedy of damages. Ordinarily, when a person violates the legal rights of another, a court will order the wrongdoer to pay damages measured by the plaintiff's loss. The primary goal is to put the plaintiff in as good a position as he would have been in absent the wrongdoer's actions. See Williston, Law of Contracts, Section 1338, 1920. See also Dobbs stating, damages is an instrument of corrective justice, an effort to put the plaintiff in his or her rightful position. Historically, equity has provided a different option in certain circumstances. After a showing that the defendant interfered with the plaintiff's legally protected rights, courts sitting in equity have long issued remedies designed to deprive wrongdoers of their net profits from unlawful activity. These remedies have taken varying forms and gone under different names, restitution and disgorgement among them. All come with important limitations. For our purposes in this case, though, only one common feature matters. Generally, the final award to the plaintiff is not measured by his loss, but by the defendant's gain attributable to his wrongdoing against the plaintiff. The answer to this case follows from that distinction. Under traditional equitable principles, a victim seeking disgorgement of a defendant's unlawful gains does not need to prove he has suffered a corresponding loss, or, indeed, any loss. Instead, when a victim has suffered an interference with protected interests, he may be entitled to restitution of the defendant's wrongful gain from that interference, even when he has suffered no measurable loss whatsoever. The point of the remedy is for the defendant to give to the plaintiff the amount by which he has been enriched from the wrongful invasion of the plaintiff's legally protected interests, not to compensate the plaintiff for a financial loss. By way of illustration, consider Raven Red Ash Coal Company v. Ball, 1946. There, a company had acquired the right to mine coal from a tract of land, part of which was owned by the plaintiff. Along with that right, the company also received an easement to cross the land, but only for the purpose of digging for, mining, or otherwise securing the coals from the tract in question. The company did just that, constructing a railroad across the land and using it to transport coal. But, without authorization, the company also used the railroad to transport coal from other tracts of land. The plaintiff sued, alleging that the company had exceeded the scope of its easement. A jury agreed, awarding the plaintiff $500, even though he admitted that he had suffered no more damage than being occasionally excluded from the land when the additional coal carts happened to pass through. And an appellate court affirmed the award because it represented a fair value of the benefits the company unjustly received from its trespass. In other words, the plaintiff, whose legally protected interest had been invaded, was entitled to the defendant's gain from that wrongful conduct even without showing pecuniary loss. Many other cases are of a piece. In Corey v. Struve, 1915, the plaintiff leased land to the defendants and granted them a limited right to plow under the tops of beets growing there for use as a fertilizer. Instead, the defendants sold the beet tops to be eaten by cattle. The parties agreed that the plaintiff suffered no pecuniary loss because of this deviation from their deal. Even so, the court ordered the defendants to turn over to the plaintiff the proceeds of the sale of his property wrongfully made. In Edwards v. Lee, 1936, a man opened a cave as a tourist attraction, but about a third of the cave sat under land belonging to his neighbor. The court ordered the exhibitor to hand over a third of his profits to his neighbor, and it did so despite the fact the cave was inaccessible from the neighbor's property, and he suffered no loss from its use as a tourist attraction. In Olwell v. Nye and Nissen Company, 1946, a court ordered the defendant to pay its profits from its unauthorized use of an automatic egg-washing machine belonging to the plaintiff, even though the plaintiff had no use for it at the time. A number of our own decisions, too, proceeded similarly. What all these, and a great many other cases, have in common is this. Applying traditional equitable principles, a court ordered the defendant to disgorge the value of the gain attributable to his invasion of the plaintiff's legally protected interests without requiring a showing of pecuniary loss, and to know that much is enough to know the answer to this case. Whatever else traditional equitable principles demand, they do not require a showing of pecuniary loss before a court may issue an award of unjust profits. Resisting this conclusion, Mr. Shripetch offers a variety of arguments, the most salient of which bear mention. For starters, he contends that Lew precludes the outcome we reach. As he reads it, that decision already announced a rule requiring the SEC to make a showing of pecuniary loss before securing disgorgement. We disagree. To be sure, and as Mr. Shripetch stresses, Lew held that disgorgement must be awarded for victims. But as we have seen, Lew drew this requirement from traditional equitable principles, and those principles do not demand a showing of pecuniary loss before a person may qualify as a victim entitled to an award of a wrongdoer's profits. Relatedly, Mr. Shripetch submits that allowing a court to award his victims monetary relief, even when they have not suffered any pecuniary loss, would be inconsistent with Lew's description of disgorgement as a remedy designed to restore the status quo. Again, we disagree. Perhaps in a perfect world, every remedy would restore the status quo by putting both a wrongdoer and his victim in the same position they would have occupied absent the wrongful conduct. But in some instances, a defendant can unjustly enrich himself even without leaving a plaintiff worse off financially. And in those instances, a court must choose between two status quos. It can either restore the defendant to his prior position by stripping him of his unjust gains, or it can allow the defendant to benefit from his misconduct because the plaintiff's financial position has not changed. And, as the cases above illustrate, equity traditionally prefers the first outcome, not the second. See also Falk v. Hoffman, 1922, stating equity will not be over nice in balancing the efficacy of one remedy against the efficacy of another when action will baffle and inaction may confirm the purpose of the wrongdoer. At bottom, Mr. Shripetch's real worry seems to be that, without a pecuniary loss requirement, The SEC might lose sight of traditional equitable principles altogether. It might, he says, try to use Congress's newly added provision in Section 7(8)(UD) as a tool to resume its efforts to seek penalties for the Treasury rather than compensation for victims. Such a result, Mr. Shripetch reminds us, would hardly be consistent with traditional equitable principles, which never lend their aid to a penalty. And, he hints, we should be on high alert for this problem given that, in this very case, the district court did not require the SEC to explain how it planned to distribute its disgorgement award to wronged investors. This argument may proceed from a sound premise, but falters in its conclusion. Should the government seek to depart from traditional equitable principles and attempt to use Section 7(8)(UD) to secure penalties, it would of course proceed beyond what Lew held Section 7(8)(UD) tolerates. That development would raise questions about whether and to what degree Section 7(8)(UD) permits deviation from equitable principles, and it would invite other questions too. See, for example, SEC v. Jarkazi, decided in 2024, holding that, when the SEC seeks penalties, the Seventh Amendment entitles the defendant to a jury trial. But none of this means, as Mr. Shripetch suggests, that we should hold the SEC's disgorgement remedy requires proof of pecuniary loss, a requirement foreign to Liu and to traditional equitable principles alike. Mr. Shripetch's amici offer one more way still in which, they say, a decision for the SEC in this case could risk transforming disgorgement into a penalty. They point to the traditional equitable principle that disgorgement is appropriate only in cases where a defendant has violated a victim's legally protected rights. See, for example, Brief for Chamber of Commerce of the United States of America as Amicus Curiae 1112. And they express concern that the Commission might try to seek disgorgement even for securities, law violations that do not invade the legally protected interests of any investor. But that worry, too, is beside the point in this case, for, as it comes to us, Mr. Shripetch has not disputed that his victims suffered a violation of their legally protected interests. Because traditional equitable principles do not require a showing of pecuniary loss to justify a disgorgement award, and nothing in Liu teaches otherwise, the judgment of the Ninth Circuit is affirmed. It is so ordered.